Coming up on Boston Public Radio, an American member of ISIS is killed. Should it heighten concerns about the terrorist group targeting the U.S.? We'll discuss that and militarization of police in our cities with former Homeland Security official and gubernatorial candidate Juliette Kayyem. Then we'll ask you, would our cities be safer? In fact, would the world be safer and more conflict-free if women were in charge?
Our medical ethicist Art Kaplan on medical marijuana helping to solve, yes, solve, another drug addiction epidemic and the crisis of sleep-deprived American kids. So, with school starting, we'll ask you, should schools start later? Then, as we head into Labor Day weekend, we'll talk with Garen Daly about the best and worst of workplace movies. All that coming up on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Eakin. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. Hello, Jim.
Hey there. Do you want my daily meteorological report?
I knew you were going to say this
today.
I'm going to
do it. You ready?
Yes.
Summer has finally arrived.
It's a steamer, Jim.
Yes, it is. Okay, so an American is killed in Syria, but this time it's not a hostage scenario. It's because he was fighting for ISIS rebels. Cops are crossing the thin blue line and entering a war zone of sorts by arming themselves with military gear and weapons. Joining us in Studio 3 to take on these subjects is Homeland Security expert and former candidate for governor, Juliette Kayyem. She's with us every Wednesday for Open Mic. Hello there, Juliette.
Hi, how are you? It is hot.
It is hot.
It is hot.
I love this kind of weather. Anyway, let's start with this Douglas McCain, this
right.
guy that was fighting with ISIS and was killed. You know, there's a lot of talk and a lot of military people saying that this is evidence that Americans are going there to fight, which obviously it is. But isn't it also evidence that there's an attraction for Americans there and that those same Americans might come back here and do dastardly things?
Right. It's hard to speak of a trend when we have only one data point, which is McCain. So I just want to state the obvious. Throughout America's history, our own citizens have fought for foreign powers and people that were our enemies. McCain is... who knows who he is, right? He might be a sociopath. He's probably, you know, lonely, wanted to feel or identify with something bigger. Clearly was not sophisticated because he started putting hints all over Twitter, which, you know, wannabe terrorist want, you know, that's sort of not a good way to go if you
right.
want to be a successful terrorist. I thought the good news out of this was the extent to which he was under U.S. surveillance because of his travel, which is, for me, is the big deal, is that, you know, we simply – cannot have a system in which, let's say, we have more onerous visa requirements for Europeans. Some people are suggesting that now because many Europeans have joined ISIS. Our commercial activity, our global economy wouldn't survive with more onerous travel restrictions. So it is interesting that the U.S. says that he was under surveillance for some time. They had lost him in Turkey, and then he shows up dead with ISIS.
But you know, my fear about this is that in light of the fact that America is war weary, and there
right.
is some legitimate concern, I think, about are we really involved in what is going to end up being mission creep in Iraq? Are we going to bomb ISIS across the border in Syria? Is this a perfect opportunity for the administration to sort of scare people into saying, well, wait a second, this guy was a Michael Jordan
right.
fan. He's just like you. And when he trains there, he can come back here.
Yeah.
There are a lot of other Douglas McCains who you have to fear. So without actually saying, don't worry, there's about to be another 9/11, they essentially have the vehicle
yeah.
to gin up support for behavior that otherwise wouldn't get it. You know where I'm going?
I agree with you. The last week and a half, I was incredibly critical of what I called, like, you know, all the generals coming out and sort of terrifying all of us the last 9 or 10 days, including statements that are just outrageous. Like, one of these guys could come into a shopping mall and shoot an AK-47 and kill, you know, 100 people. First of all, that could happen anyway, right? We know that, certainly. Second, that's just no way to talk to us about the possibility of war. And so the capacity for someone to do something bad in the United States exists all the time. And what we need to know is how imminent is it? Can we disrupt the potential for a terrorist attack? And then if we are going to do something more in Syria, Let's have a rational, honest discussion about what it means. Right wing, a lot of the right wing that is pushing for more involvement in Syria, and I certainly don't have a good answer for it. I mean, I'd like to know. I mean, it's a good thing that we're trying to get more intelligence. It'd be good to go. If we do increase military action, it'd be good this time to have some intelligence on what we're doing. But this notion that, oh, it doesn't really matter if we're bombing in Iraq because there's no such thing as a Syrian border and it's all mushy over there. To listeners, don't believe it, because Assad has borders. He recognizes his borders. And even if he doesn't have control of what's going on in parts of his country, it changes the dynamic for us to bomb in Syria. And we have to have that conversation. The administration, if it's going to bomb, has to be honest that we are violating the sovereignty of another nation, but that it's worth it. And stop this homeland fear mongering. There's just no evidence that there is an imminent threat. And it's and get the generals in line, because the Pentagon has just been way out ahead of the White House on this.
We're talking to security expert Juliette Kayyem.
I sound mad? I apologize.
No,
but it's okay.
It sounded
like the run up to Iraq, and it's for those of us who post a war in Iraq, it was too familiar.
Well,
and we just have
headline.
To push back.
Look at this headline in the Globe today: U.S. preparing to widen assault on Islamic State. That sounds like ratcheting things up to me. But the existential question, I think, if you're a layperson like I am, is are we better off ratcheting up our military adventurism overseas, or are we better off saying ISIS-like groups are going to be there? What we need to do is figure out how to keep those ISIS-type groups from getting into the United States, the homeland, the homegrown terrorism kind of thing. The latter seems to me to make much more sense than the former, but I don't have your expertise.
So, unfortunately, they are related. So it's a combination of the defense and offense. So obviously, fortify our borders to the extent possible. The visa, check to see where people are, where they've been going. We actually do have a rigorous system for it. Check social media. These guys who are posting, and there's a lot of surveillance going on. Work with our allies. Try to stop the money flow, which came up in the Foley incident.
James Foley.
Right, James Foley. The journalist, because of a question of whether there would be ransom paid. And then, of course, military action. I don't have a good answer on the Syria question. It seems to me it is likely that we will have to align, and I put a line in quotes, with Assad to disrupt ISIS there. They've been incredibly successful in gaining geographic traction. But if Assad considers it a violation of his sovereignty, I don't think it's very helpful to have people suggest that it doesn't really matter because there's no such thing as borders there.
Well,
it will change the dynamic.
By the way, it's another legal issue. You said that, I apologize if I'm angry. A lot of people should be angry, including members of Congress. This is yet another president who talked about presidents needing to get congressional authorization after 60 or 90 days of starting bombing and those sort of things under the War Powers Act, who is saying, well, it really doesn't apply. Like virtually every candidate come president ends up saying. But let's leave that for a second, because it's too aggravating for me, and get back to something you just mentioned. Yesterday, Marjorie and I had a fairly spirited discussion about the whole notion of whether or not ransom should be paid, cash ransom should be paid for people like James Foley. Everybody knows it's not the policy of the United States is not to do it. And an issue arose we figured was perfect. We were discussing with Charlie Sennett and then with the listeners that arose that we thought you were perfect for, is the odd juxtaposition of a United States that says we don't pay ransom, but Phil Balboni, my former boss at NECN, now head of Global Post, saying we were trying to raise money to ransom. We and the Foley family were trying to raise money to pay the ransom to get James Foley back. When the policy of the United States is one thing, is it legal for individuals or organizations to be doing the same thing the United States says it won't do?
Well, absolutely not if it's a terrorist organization. So it's a complicated series of rules. So first of all, generally, we have a prohibition in the United States of individuals and even states having their own foreign policy. So do you remember when Massachusetts had stronger prohibitions on Burma? It was called Burma at the time than the United States did. Massachusetts did not allow companies to do any business with Burma in a much more strict manner than the U.S. government. Massachusetts lost the case with the Supreme Court saying, even states can't have their own foreign policy. But in terms of criminal statutes, my guess is that the Foleys thought that they would never be prosecuted. getting around all the logistics of how you raise the money, get it to them, whether you even trust ISIS, it would be considered material support to a terrorist organization to give them money. And it is the my heart goes out because my husband and I were talking about this morning. I said, I you know, if I could find $5 million, I'd give it to them, you know, but you cannot do it because there are so many other dynamics going on. So they give $5 million for their son. There are other families that have their own sons. And I think ultimately it was probably the right thing. And let me just say why. Because that $5 million or $500 million, I forget how much ISIS was asking.
132.
Would have gone to kill 10, 20, 30 U.S. service
members. Yeah, but then one quickly, if you can, weigh in on something that Marjorie and I had a debate about yesterday, again with Charlie Sennett. And Marjorie this morning, when I continued the debate, said I was a dope for not understanding.
I should just answer with words like that.
So let's see if you can explain it better to me so I'm not a dope. Explain to me why it is not okay to give money to terrorists to get an individual like James Foley back, but it is okay to give five Taliban prisoners from Guantanamo to the enemy, to terrorists, to get Sergeant Bergdahl back. Why is that distinction defensible?
The legal distinction is just an exchange of prisoners of war. Right, okay. There are, unfortunately, 100 more James Foleys who will either be captured because we've now created the incentive structure to have them captured.
By giving them money?
By giving them
money. Well, there's an incentive. If you capture him, we're going to give you five Taliban prisoners.
But five Taliban prisoners in exchange for another prisoner is a traditional, recognized, law of war between two parties. This is essentially, first of all, it's a terrorist organization. So, I don't even know if you would call them a party. But just the millions would go to killing U.S. service members or our allies. There's no question about it. Why do you think ISIS wants $150 million?
What are those five Taliban members going to do when they go back? They're going to kill Americans?
That's true of every armed conflict. But
so you think I'm a dope too? Is that what you're saying?
I guess prisoner exchanges. Prisoner exchanges.
There's always been
exchanges. The Geneva Conventions and the rules of war. This, I mean, obviously, the Foleys were counting on no one prosecuting them, but if ISIS got stronger, let's assume they could have raised that much and was able to buy arms that then killed not just service members, but killed whomever. I mean, it doesn't end. But you're not a dope, because if I were Mrs. Foley, who has – and that family has just been tremendous, I would have tried to raise money too.
But yeah. I was curious about that, though, the prosecution angle. I can't imagine who's going to prosecute the family of a hostage for raising money. Or I don't know, maybe they would prosecute Global Post if Phil Balboni was raising money. But has that ever even happened?
No, but I mean, because most people, I mean, my guess is that they talked to their lawyers. Their lawyer said, you are clearly going to be violating criminal law. This is not civil law. This is criminal law. Yeah. It's not aiding and abetting. It's material support for a terrorist organization. It's a tough law. It is you go to jail. But I can't imagine a prosecutor doing it.
Right.
But let's just be if it makes it difficult if, on the one hand, the U.S. policy, it's not just the U.S. policy, most countries, there's very few countries that will pay ransom.
Western Europe pays it.
Switzerland,
France. Well, France says they don't, but they do. And by the way, we mentioned this yesterday, but it's worth repeating that France, which according to this piece in the New York Times, had raised more money, even though they said they don't, to pay ransom, is also the country that has had the most hostages taken because the incentive is there to take French hostages because they know that the French are going to give them money.
You know, in a second, we're going to move to something where you had personal experience when you're doing Homeland Security under Deval Patrick. Before we do, it's very hard to say there's a light moment. And I maybe even shouldn't use that word when you're talking about ISIS. But one of my favorite things with the media is this, is when the reporter sternly asked Barack Obama or one of his people, Mr. President or Mr. Secretary, so-and-so and so-and-so, ISIS. And then the administration person comes back and says, well, yes, as far as ISIL goes. Now, technically, one is the same thing. Islamic State of Iraq and Syria is ISIS. ISIL is the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant. And Levant is a larger description of the geographical area. But Marjorie and I were discussing this morning. Is the reason the administration does it is because, I mean this sincerely, is because ISIS is a soft sounding word. It's the Egyptian goddess of
or
motherhood or something. Why do they do that? It's so weird. It's like a Saturday Night Live
thing. You know what's
thing.
Weird is that the New York Times will use ISIS and then they'll quote someone ISIL. And then after the quote, they'll say the administration was using another name for ISIS. And so the translation to ISIS was probably wrong originally. This is what's weird. From Arabic. And it was actually the Associated Press that tried to get everyone to change to ISIL as being a better translation and more reflective of the branding of what it is ISIL is trying to do. And not many people followed suit. The administration has consistently used ISIL. It is the strangest thing. I can't say ISIL. I say ISIS because I just got used to it.
So you don't think it's about the softness of the sound of the term?
No, I think it was a translation and it just got captured one way or the other. I mean, it'd be interesting because I think I haven't looked at an AP story, but I think they're using ISIL.
We're talking with Juliette Kayyem, Homeland Security expert. You may recall her name as well because she ran for governor a couple of months ago. Anyway, you wrote a great piece in the Globe about the Ferguson situation with where Michael Brown was killed and the policing that went on there. I remember right after the Marathon bombing, the Atlantic Online did this incredible photo essay of police officers going into Watertown to look for the younger Tsarnaev brother. And I was stunned by it because you saw these cops, local cops, with these really military-looking vehicles and these really ramped-up suits and weaponry and guns and the helmets and the riot gear and all this kind of stuff. And you saw the same thing in Ferguson. And you also saw police officers pointing their guns directly at people, which, correct me if I'm wrong, military people don't do. They don't, you know, when they're facing unarmed people. So tell us the thesis of your bad policing, bad policing.
And tell us about your involvement in this.
So I've been in Homeland Security for a very long time, or had been, and oversaw the state's Homeland Security apparatus, which included the federal funds. So just a little bit of history. After 9/11, billions of dollars went to states and localities to support counterterrorism. That tended to flow to police departments, which also allowed the use of that funds to buy excess military equipment. So long story short, lots of police departments with often no training, no oversight, no question about why the heck they need it, were in possession of this stuff. And my point in the article was that 9/11 was a lot of things. It was also a form of amnesia because it's not like we woke up one day and 9/11 happened. There's a history to this country, and we should have learned the lesson of the past, because during World War II, there was a debate between Eleanor Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and New York City Mayor LaGuardia about protecting the homeland. And LaGuardia has this great line where he says, we need stuff, right? We need stuff. And this was before Pearl Harbor. And he hates Eleanor Roosevelt. He finds her, all of her Red Cross volunteerism stuff. And it was the boy versus the girl. And he goes, all the stuff she does, that's the sissy stuff.
That's great.
I mean, which you can't even imagine anyone saying anymore.
Great story.
Right. So the sense of community empowerment, preparedness, volunteerism was viewed as sissy, and that the boys, as I say, the boys with their toys, were buying guns. And we forgot everything. And that, I'm sorry, let me just say, that debate essentially was ended by President Nixon, who, among many things, said, and faced many hurricanes and many natural disasters, said, this is crazy. We have to buy equipment that's for what he called, what we call, dual use. In other words, the hose is good for the fire, and whether it's started by the arsonist or the cigarette smoker, the surge capacity for public health that we saw after the Boston Marathon, they didn't care when they were there whether it was generators or two brothers from Cambridge, right? You have to have the capacity to be nimble, and we forgot about that nimbleness. Enter Ferguson. You give people guns that have no other use. There's no dual use to an AK-47. There's no dual use to a tank. It's intended to terrify in a theater of operations, right?
Right.
Which tends to be Afghanistan and Iraq. And so my argument was just like, let's just remember that, first of all, police departments do better when they are tied to the community and community policing. And the two proposals I have, because I do think there are solutions. One is allow some of this gear to urban police departments that have dedicated teams. Give it to a SWAT team. Give it to that are trained and consistently trained where there's oversight. And You know, the other recommendation I had is the funds, Homeland Security funds, almost were impossible to buy people. You could buy equipment really easily. But if we actually think about the long-term security of this nation, we should think about letting those funds be used for bilingual police officers, community engagement specialists, more female police officers. You said the Ferguson pictures weren't only incredible because they were all white, they were all men.
Yes.
So those were some of my recommendations. I have, you know, given that we need to begin to grab back the 9/11 apparatus that grew so fast.
Can I tell you that you were such a sissy? It's
unbelievable. I know.
Before you leave this, though,
I'm not leaving it.
There's two women in the studio, one man. Yeah. There is such a go out there with our big bad guns and mono.
I mean, there's a great program at the Kennedy School called Women Waging Peace, which is a way of women to come together and demand peace in their nations, mostly African nations. And I said, you know, God, my career is like men waging war. You know, it's like it is. And there's a way they talk and a way that they bully. And you hear it a little bit in the run up to wars, right?
Absolutely.
You know, the names I was called for opposing the Iraq war as showing some skepticism that Syria will be fine with us bombing. It's a little bit of a little girl. And I can push out back because I've been in the field. But as I like to say to a lot of these men, so to speak, you know, you may sound certain, but you are not always right. And I say that to any young woman entering my field.
I want you to know that Deval Patrick, about 5 years ago, said to me on the radio, Jim's motto should be sometimes wrong, never in doubt.
Yes. So there, no, it's totally.
Okay,
but
can we stay on this one more second?
This is a big deal.
Yeah, I
want to
stay
on
this.
Would be a lot better off if there were women in charge of foreign policy.
Okay, fine, but that's not a topic today.
Can we just stay?
By the way, there
have
been a lot of women in charge of foreign policy in the United States in recent years. How did Condoleezza Rice do?
Have we had a president?
How did Condoleezza?
Oh, we're already there. Yeah.
Okay.
Condoleezza Rice was the outliers.
You obviously had some impact because I just looked at the dates. Your piece appeared in the Globe on August 20th. 2 days later, the Obama administration announces a comprehensive review.
I have friends.
But okay, so he talks about exactly what you're talking about, an examination of the government's decade-old strategy of this outfitting local police with military-grade armor, mine-resistant trucks, etc., and training. Does anything come of this, or is this purely a sop to those who are upset? No, I don't mean that in a critical way. And a lot of Americans who are upset about what they saw on television in Ferguson.
I think that if there's any news, good news coming out of Ferguson, I think it's going to give the political cover for the administration, the Justice Department, Department of Homeland Security, to take on Congress. It's this has been being pushed by Congress as well, who wants gear for all of their localities to reassess this. There is a role for military-type equipment. It should normally go with the National Guard. That's why we have a National Guard or major urban police departments. And that's about it. And then start to give some flexibility, some sissiness, if I can say, to this money to support more diversity, bilingual, you know, just a community engagement. Police officers will be a safer country because
of that. Can I tell you, when you run for office next time, which you're clearly going to do.
What did you talk about?
Can I tell you something?
Yeah, I have a great strategy. I'm coming on air with you
the
every week.
The sissification of Massachusetts, that I'm telling you, is the ticket. Trust me.
And I would like to point out to you
Mr.
Browdy,
that
Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton do not make a feminist public policy on foreign affairs and wars.
Well, there was Madeleine Albright,
okay. I think that's a tiny, tiny, tiny minority.
You can't even imagine, you know, saying that something is the sissy stuff. And he was talking about Eleanor Roosevelt.
How many times have people called Obama those kinds of words?
No,
it's amazing to me how he can be such a sissy in foreign affairs and such a tyrant domestically. Yeah. It is incredible. He can walk both those lines at the same time. Anything else to say, Jimmy?
No, I don't.
Juliet,
great to see you.
We
are. We're leaving you, too.
We're moving on.
Okay, thank you.
Juliet, thank you so much for being in here and bringing up the sissification deal. I absolutely love it.
I want the next 2 hours or however long. You guys are on for like 9 hours, right?
Starting September.
Hours in a row, just the two of you.
Day. Juliet Keim is a Homeland Security expert, a very smart one, too. She joins us Wednesdays for Open Mic. Juliet, thank you
for
being
both.
Here. Actually, we're not totally moving on. We're going to stick with the sissification topic for a little while longer because you heard Juliette Kayyem and I talking about whether women running foreign policy and holding high-ranking government positions would mean waging fewer wars. And also, there'd be a much smaller emphasis on military might. Would there or wouldn't there be? That's what we want to ask you next. Is warmongering gender neutral? Or would the state of world peace be different if more women were in charge? I know what I think. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, which was a big mistake on your part, you missed our discussion with Homeland Security expert Juliette Kayyem. She and Marjorie were discussing if we'd be a little closer to the utopia known as world peace if more women were in charge. And by peace, I'm talking about everything from police behavior to dropping bombs in other parts of the world. We want to know where you are on this at 877-301-8970. Is a woman's instinct to collaborate, let's say the salve that can save the world, or as Marjorie posed it a minute ago, is aggression gender neutral? 877-301-8970. I think we have different positions on this, Marjorie, so why don't you start things off?
Well, I think, Jim, clearly there's something wrong with a lot of men. We know that, don't we? I mean, who's doing all the shooting? Who's doing all the killing? Who's doing all the sexual assaulting? Who's running around taking pictures up women's dresses and stuff like that? We have that happening in Boston all the time. On the T, who are the serial killers? I mean, they're men for the most part. It's not like every man is Rambo and every woman is, you know, little Bo Peep. But I generally would say that a lot of foreign policy in America is about, as Juliette Kayyem just said, who's a sissy? Who's not a sissy? You know, when George Bush got up there after 9/11 and said, we're going to come get you, Osama bin Laden, we're going to take care of the people that did this. We love that because that was John Wayne. That was Rambo. That was the Terminator. And a woman, I mean, it's true that there had been
a lot of... It's also defending our country and responding the killing of thousands of Americans.
But that plays into the whole macho thing that we like. We're cowboy nation. You know, we're very machismo rules in the United States of America.
Okay, you went on for a minute there. It was very impressive. But,
did you tell me?
I did. I will just give you four words. You want the four words?
Certainly.
Thatcher, Rice, Clinton, Palin. Now, I will give you a choice, Marjorie, which I rarely do. Would you like to hear from Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, or Margaret Thatcher? Which would you prefer?
And I will tell you that the reason we have people like Margaret Thatcher and Golda Meir and Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton is because women, knowing they will be judged as less tough because they're female, have to go out of their way to prove to be tough. Now, Margaret Thatcher...
So we should never elect them as leaders if they can't be tough enough, obviously, to make decisions on the merits rather than how they're going to be judged.
How many other women leaders can you name that weren't there because of their husbands or their fathers or their widows or they're the daughters of leaders? I mean, this is such a new thing. You have to prove your toughness. That's why many people would say that the first woman president of the United States has to be a Republican, because Republicans are generally viewed as more hawkish than Democrats.
Okay. Well, actually, this person is viewed as pretty hawkish by some since you chose Hillary Clinton. Here she is speaking in Toronto in June, a couple of months ago. She is admitting about how wrong she was on her vote to authorize the Iraq War. Listen to Hillary Clinton.
I made a mistake when I voted to give President Bush authority with respect to Iraq. And even though I thought I had made the best decision I could under difficult circumstances and later came to just be absolutely regretful, if not dumbfounded, by the way that the administration implemented that decision.
The front runner to be the leader of the free world come 2016, Hillary Rodham Clinton. 877-301-8970. In fairness to you, I saw the same polls you did this morning. Support of military force. These are American men and women. Judging the last six military conflicts we're involved in, 51% of men supported, only 43% of women. Anthropologists say the tribal women, you know, never invaded, never got together to invade neighboring villages. So there's some of that there, too. But my sense is that at least recent history suggests that the question you asked before is aggression gender neutral? The answer is pretty much yes.
And I think it has to do with the fact that because women in leadership roles are such a new phenomenon, that women have to play by the men's rules
to get there.
Yeah,
maybe actually there probably is. And they're also surrounded by men in many of these settings.
It's also not across the board. There are some exceptions to the rules. And Margaret Thatcher, that you mentioned before, may be one of them. But generally speaking, I think for women, it is not all about who's got the biggest you-know-whats in the room.
No, I agree.
And for men,
it
is in the United States of America anyway, it's almost all about that. I'm impressed, by the way, that you could admit, that you're sort of a chicken. You've said that many times.
I never said I was a chicken, but go ahead.
But it's one thing to say you're a chicken when you're very tall. Jim is 6'5" and you have a deep voice.
Now,
it would be harder to admit you were a chicken if you were 5'4" and you had kind of a wussy little voice. And then it would be harder to admit.
Well, you jokingly talk about use the word chicken.
Mm-hmm.
It in one of my favorite terms and least favorite terms simultaneously is chicken hawk. I mean, these people we're talking about, with very few exceptions, don't go participate in the aggressive behavior at all. They just order other people to participate in that behavior, which is also another issue. Our number is 877-301-8970. Let's start with Andy. I think Andy is calling from the Philippines, I think. Is that right? Hello, Andy. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
That's correct. I listen to you on my computer.
Well, thank you for doing that.
I spent some time in Greater Boston some years ago, so listening to all those place names rings back a lot of good memories.
I'm glad to hear that. Why are you calling today, Andy?
Well, first of all, I was going to take you to task because anytime you appease kidnappers with ransom, it was done in Mexico in 1996. The president of Sanyo Electronics was kidnapped in Tijuana. They paid a $2 million ransom for his release. And after that, Mexico turned into the country with the largest number of kidnappings in the world, outpacing Colombia. As a matter of fact, I was held prisoner there 241 days myself.
By whom? By whom, Andy?
Well, they were people looking for some money. They wanted $150,000 for my release, and I refused to pay. And you're not worth anything dead. So I was subsequently released. But what I'm saying is that here in the Philippines, in the early 2000s, there were two American missionaries, the Burnhams, were kidnapped by the local branch of Al-Qaeda, the Abu Sayyaf, and a ransom was paid for their release. And then they changed the terms and they wanted more money. Their church in the United States raised the money and paid $250,000, and then they wanted more money. And Mr. Burnham ended up being killed, and his wife was wounded in a gun battle with a Philippine military.
Hey, Andy, can I make a request of you? We are very interested in talking to you. Can we put you on hold? And one of our producers is going to get a number for you, and we'd like to talk to you and probably have you back to discuss that topic, since we've spent a couple of days on it. Andy, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970. What we're talking about right now is the whole question of whether or not women in charge would change how we do policing in the wake of what happened in Ferguson. And by the way, I'm not talking about the individual who did the shooting. We're talking about the militarization of police that's being discussed from everybody from Juliette Kayyem to Barack Obama, and also foreign policy, wars, those sorts of things.
Let's go to Brian in Vermont. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Brian.
Hey, how you doing? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thanks for the call.
Great show. Happy to be on.
Thank you.
So I was just thinking, there's a lot of evidence in the world of mountain climbing and backcountry skiing, especially skiing in avalanche terrain in the backcountry, that women have fewer accidents, fewer injuries, and generally contribute to the greater safety of a group or an expedition. And I think that reality could and should play out on a greater scale with respect to international issues by having women more involved and more often at the helm of some of these major issues we're dealing with.
What is the analysis as to why the outcomes are like you described, that they are risk-averse or more collaborative? What's the analysis, Brian?
Well, there's no doubt, I think we all know, there's been plenty of songs sung about it, that women are smarter and they have better instincts. And I think they're so smart that they stay out of politics and stay out of, you know, really demanding executive roles more than men do. They have less ego. But to the extent that we can encourage women to get more involved, I think it's going to be a benefit generally to society. And we should be putting more resources in that respect. You were talking earlier about funds for local police departments being used for primarily gear purchases. Yeah. But we should be hiring more female law enforcers that can be community liaisons, that can instill a greater sense of peace and calm and less aggression in terms of power throughout our law enforcement
community. You know, Brian, you're why we love Vermonters, I have to say.
And you're a former Vermonter, Margaret.
Oh, you lived there for a year. A great state. Brian,
thanks for the call.
Thank you very much for those great points and that great call.
And what's your analysis, again, the first names that come to mind, and I didn't cherry pick these, when you think of people like Sarah Palin, who for a while was the leading Republican voice in America, when you think of Hillary Clinton, who at least according to the polls, is the next president of the United States, when you think of Condoleezza Rice, when you think of Margaret Thatcher, these aren't names. I didn't choose aggressive, pro-militaristic women. They were just the first names that came to my head.
There's a lot of recent history about the whole Iraq buildup, which has Condoleezza Rice basically being overruled and sidelined by Dick Cheney. So I'm not exactly sure that she was as much of a war hawk as you're portraying her to be. And also, as I said before, I mean, why do you think Hillary Clinton voted in favor of the war in Iraq? Do you think she thought that was the way to go, or do you think she thought she needed to do that to prove she had the you-know-whats to be running for president?
Well, by the way, John Kerry is a man, and many people believe, I amongst them, that the reason he supported the war in Iraq, considering, by the way, his illustrious behavior when he came back from Vietnam, was because Bob Schrum, who was his consultant, said you can't be elected president of the United States unless you support the war in Iraq. So men fall into the same trap as women.
Don't forget what happened to him when he was running for president, where people were belittling his service in Vietnam and saying, he was only there for a few months, and he got shot once, and he left, and they were undermining questioning how big of a hero he was.
But isn't it interesting,
had to prove that he was a hero.
But the guy who didn't give in to that, who is not exactly perceived as a tough guy by many people in this country, and the primary reason, in my estimation, that he ended up beating Hillary Clinton in the primaries was Barack Obama. I mean, it's not exactly a hawk in general.
Well, let's not overanalyze this, but you could also make an argument that who is perceived to be the most macho men in America in general?
I don't know.
Black men.
And your point is,
he's black. I mean, I think
I don't understand the point. He is not seen as a macho man by...
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about foreign policy, his opponents would portray him as a sissy.
Now.
If you're talking about domestic policy, he's portrayed as a tyrant that does whatever he wants. So it's all over the map. But I think he was coming for a place where it might have been easier for him, and also I think nobody really thought he had a chance back when he's running against Hillary Clinton.
877-301-8970. Let's go to Rhode Island, where Paul is on the phone. Paul, thanks for calling Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling in defense of that women would do a better job. I'm in my mid-70s, and I remember my grandmother. I was born and raised in New York City. Mm-hmm. And her big thing was that the reason there was so much many problems was that the grandmothers weren't doing their jobs. If they were doing their job, she said, and that was because she at the time was being harassed by the mob in the city for paying protection, and she used to get annoyed when people would glorify the people that way. But now this woman was born in the late 1800s, and she was emphatic about that it was the women's fault. She didn't care how bad these guys were, but if the people that have the baby in their hand, they're the ones that, you know, produce what's happening in the world. And I just think from my experience in life, women just give another tone to it. Their first reaction usually is a pacifistic reaction before they get violent or vote for violence. I mean, to me, it's an obvious thing.
By the way, I say most of the psychological analysis that we both read this morning completely embraces your grandmother's worldview and yours. Paul, thank you for a terrific call. We appreciate it.
Well, the epidemic of violence in outside of the military is obviously, it's not women who are making up that epidemic.
Outside the military or inside the military?
No, outside the military. In the regular world, the men are obviously, particularly in that age group, 18 to 25.
That's true.
Pretty violent characters. Let's go to Melissa. I shouldn't say men are. Some men are. Melissa in Providence. Hi, Melissa.
Hello.
Hi. Hi. I wanted to call and comment on the differences between, like, aggression and violence perception, because I do a lot of research in, like, social psychology and in violence. And I think when people talk about men and women being the same with aggression, you're actually talking about something like reactive aggression. So studies will show, like, oh, men and women react the same way when something's, like, you know, attacking them, even their ego included. But violence sensitivity is different. It's how you perceive situations, and there is a gender difference. Women end up being more violence sensitive, thinking that things like bullying and, you know, rape and things like that, they vote that as being more violent than men usually. And remember, we're talking group, so it's not always the same across the board. We're not saying all men don't
care.
Sure,
of course.
But what ends up happening is people that are more violence sensitive are actually more idealistic as opposed to being relativistic. So what essentially that's saying is, instead of saying that some violence can be okay depending on the situation, the idealistic people are saying, no matter what, like, this is the right thing to do. So, and do you get where I'm going?
Yeah, and but what happens to that idealism, to use your word, when you're surrounding by people who are, to use your other word, relativists? I mean, meaning women today coming into leadership are surrounded by those other people, men, who, so how does that affect, because much of the stuff we read today also said a lot of this research is in isolation. It's not in the in the environment that I'm describing. Do you understand what I'm saying, Melissa?
Yeah, absolutely. The research that everyone looks at is usually that one-on-one, you know, if somebody's going to be aggressive in a, like, specific but a small situation. On a bigger scale like this, I think that's really where the idealism, relativism comes in, because they're trying to think, like, okay, what are we going to do in a big situation? What's the right thing to do? Who's going to get hurt? Who are we going to save? And so idealists say the best thing to do is the thing that will help the most people. But relativists are ones that would be like, no, attacking them is justified because they attacked us first.
Understood.
So I think that just, like, the ideal, and there's a lot of males that are also doing research, you know, in this area, and they agree with me. So, I don't want to put that on, oh, only females think that way. But the mindset for a lot of people, and actually in the study, more Republicans than Democrats are also, like, Republicans are more relativistic and Democrats are more idealistic. So,
Melissa, thank you for sharing that information with us. Our number is 877-301-8970. And Marjorie, we haven't heard from Sarah Palin in months. And so, as a favor to you, actually,
okay.
No, really, because I know you like, no, you've always liked hearing.
I've always liked her.
From the former governor. Here's Governor Palin. She was at the CPAC, you know, the Conservative Political Action Group, on 2014 conference, and she's talking about the president of the United States. Here it is.
And safer, he would gut our arsenal while he allows others, enemies, to enrich theirs. Oh, man, that's just like a liberal on gun control. Mr. President, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a nuke is a good guy with a nuke.
I apologize. I think we played Tina Fey. I'm not sure.
Oh,
it was
God.
Either Tina Fey or it was Sarah Palin. I'm not sure. Let's go to Connecticut.
Can you believe?
Let's go to Connecticut.
Almost the vice president.
Let's go to Connecticut, where Stephen is on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Stephen. How are you?
Hey, thanks. That was, I followed everything up to the social psychologist. He was totally over my head.
Well, it's okay.
Let's go back to Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
She's a war hawk. She's going to, if Elizabeth Warren runs against her, Elizabeth's going to smoke her. Come on. She's no chance against Elizabeth Warren. She's a hawk. She's a hawk.
By the way, that's what Rand Paul called her,
I think,
on Meet the Press this week or the prior week or some such thing. Stephen, thank you for the call. So what's the verdict, Marjorie? What would you say?
I would say I was right and you were wrong.
You would, regardless of what the conversation was.
Yeah,
conversation
I do.
Was.
I think it would be different, and I think it would be a lot different, and I think it wouldn't be all about, you know, who's a bigger scaredy cat and who's not as big a scaredy cat. I mean, it's like this, you know, the book, Everything You Always Need to Know You Learned in Kindergarten. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, everybody is still in kindergarten or they never get out of high school or something like that. Okay?
Okay.
Up next, how using marijuana is connected to a declining rate in opiate overdoses. Stay tuned to hear medical ethicist Art Kaplan explain the correlation. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You'd think all of Massachusetts was smoking weed, given how we're moving in slow motion when it comes to implementing the medical marijuana law passed by the voters. So could this headline get state officials to pick up the pace? In states with medical marijuana, painkiller overdoses dropped by 25%. Join us on the line to talk about the significance of this new report and other things medical is Art Kaplan. He's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. Also the co-host of the new podcast, Everyday Ethics. Art, great to talk to you.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
Hi, Art. So this is a pretty startling headline. We usually think of, you know, the debate, what's worse, marijuana or liquor, and marijuana being a gateway drug. And you've talked a lot about this and written a lot about this, the prescription painkiller epidemic. So tell us why this is significant.
Well, basically, this study, and I was shocked to see it, but in a certain way pleased, it shows that if you give people the ability to control and self-medicate using marijuana, they really get away from the prescription drug medicines. They use less. They're safer. They don't overdose on them. They don't take the wrong ones. They don't cheat and swap to get prescription drugs that weren't written for them. So it's a real unexpected spinoff benefit from the legalization of medical marijuana, and I think it should shape the policy debate.
Will it shape the policy debate? And, well, that's one thing. And the second thing, why were you shocked?
I just didn't expect that there'd be this reduction, if you will, okay, in prescription drug abuse. I didn't make the connection between the two. I'm even interested that the researchers thought to look. It's a very clever idea.
Well, you know, my concern about its impact is, if Massachusetts is any indication, virtually every public official, almost without exceptions, every law enforcement person, every DA, the attorney general, the guy, everybody voted against it, except for the public. The public
right.
voted for it 60-40. Mm-hmm. And as you may or may not know, I hinted at this, the implementation has been a nightmare of the gang that couldn't shoot straight kind of thing. Will this have an? Do people want? Do the people in charge of governments want to take this into account? Do you know what I mean, Art?
Yeah, I do. They do. Are they listening at all?
Or do they choose not to? Right.
Yeah, and I think there is partly a political stance that says, I'm not coming out in favor of any marijuana.
Right.
That's not where I want to be seen in the next commercial. So not me, not me. On the other hand, the public keeps saying, we're ready for it. Push it through. I think it's 18 states have done it. Nobody has gone off in a haze of smoke as a result of medical marijuana. The big issue has been sort of, you know, prescription abuse for getting medical marijuana. Are too many people getting it? But even there, despite the fact that I think that's turned out to be a problem in a few states, you know, you show up with an ache or a pain or something and you can get somebody to write your prescription, it hasn't really tipped these states into some kind of reefer madness condition. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think the politicians are out of step on this one.
Yeah,
the public is basically saying, we can do it. We can handle it.
And you were just at the Reefer Madness Ground Central there out in Colorado.
Oh, I forgot. That's right.
I was.
So, you know, this is an anecdotal story, but I think it's really significant. The New York Times did a story, I don't know, a year or so ago, talking about how something like 40% of women in America, middle-aged and up, have sleeping problems.
Mm-hmm.
I have a good friend, older woman in her 60s, almost a grandmother in California, who has had sleeping problems all her life, went to the medical marijuana places out there where they apparently, according to her, tell you what different kinds of strains of pot are going to do. And
well, I can report to you on this in great detail, having studied it carefully.
Yeah, well, she went for the "this will help you sleep" marijuana, which
yes.
she cooks and puts into cookies. And after years of sleeping pills, which have a lot of side effects and problems, she's now doing the cookie thing a couple of hours before bedtime and sleeping through the night.
So someone had to go to the medical marijuana dispensary in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, during my trip there. So I volunteered. and I go. And by the way, even though it is legal recreationally in Colorado, we're not talking medical marijuana, it's still being marketed as if it were medical, which I found pretty interesting. So all the categories that we're thinking about, this is good for your aches and pains, your arthritis, your sleeping, that's how they're selling it inside the store. It doesn't just come in and, you know, here's a fifth of gin, buy it and leave. That you get the whole sort of speech, don't operate vehicles, da-da-da-da-da. So very interesting that a lot of folks, I think, worried that people would just abuse this and kids would abuse it and there'd be people wait, you know, kids waiting outside the store saying, hey, can you buy me something when you go in there, buddy? The providers are being very careful. They don't want to bring the federal government down on them. They don't want to bring any police officials down on them. So, yeah, I think you can use some of these things, self-medicate, see how they work for you. And they're probably better than some of the more powerful prescription drugs, probably less addictive. I see the case here. You know, I'm going to just say it. I think when you have tobacco legal, when you have alcohol legal, and you look at the carnage that those two things cause, even if marijuana isn't good to smoke 9 blunts a day, I'll grant that. It's hard for me to see what the medical marijuana opposition is.
Well, also, to end our conversation where we started, don't just do those. Do a comparison between OxyContin and Vicodin and those sort of things.
Absolutely right. Right.
So, you know, Art, a couple of months ago, we talked to you about some survey that showed that low and moderate income women in this country look to TV doctors for their medical information more than any other source, which was horrifying, but I guess not terribly surprising. What was almost equally horrifying to me is a study came out, a survey, a poll, I assume it was Bob Blendon, I don't know, out of the Harvard School of Public Health, about public's understanding of the dangers and threats to people in the United States from Ebola, and the lack of understanding is epic. I mean, let me just, for people who haven't seen this, 68% of Americans believe Ebola spreads easily. Is that correct, Art Kaplan?
Nope.
33% believe there's an effective medicine to treat Ebola. Is that correct?
Nope.
39% are concerned there'll be a large outbreak in the United States. Is that likely?
Nope.
So when you read something like this and do what you do for a living, do you just scratch your head and smile, or do you say, this is a real serious problem, the level of misinformation, not just here, but on other things as well?
Yeah, I do. I scratch my head, I cry a little bit, and then I smile. Something in that order, if I'm able to do those three things on any given day. But I think, you know, when you look at that level of misunderstanding, and this got intense coverage, right? Couldn't turn around for a while there without seeing an Ebola story go by. So, you know that there's a lot of information moving on the internet. I saw plenty of rumors saying, hey, you know, kids from Central America, they're bringing Ebola across the border.
Yeah.
But it was interesting that there hadn't been an outbreak or a case or anything in Central or South America. And if you could make it to the border crossing the Mexican desert with Ebola, you'd be one tough cookie, let's say. But, you know, the internet, as well as that TV, social media side, boy, do we get a lot of misinformation moving fast there. And it's hard to squash it. It's hard to reverse it. People see it. They see it in sort of type, and they say, must be true.
Well, you know, this story about misunderstanding Ebola, Jim wants to dump on the low and moderate income women watching all these TV shows.
I wasn't dumping on them.
Donald Trump was tweeting like crazy that those two Americans that were infected overseas and brought back to the United States shouldn't be allowed in because they were going to infect us all. So,
one question there was, why is Donald Trump getting any attention as the world, as America's great public health authority?
I mean, well, I can answer that question. He's going to be the next president of the United States. Of course he should get attention. What's the matter with you?
Yeah, that may be, and it'll be interesting to sort of follow his health policy throughout that era. But, you know, if you're going to put that stuff up there and say Donald is a figure and he's a celebrity and here's what he thinks, you really got to get some responsible folks saying, you know what, the chance of anybody getting out of quarantine and giving you Ebola is far less than you face driving to work listening to this show. You're going to be much more at risk of getting hurt or killed doing that. Not because of the show, just because of the operating the automobile.
You know, one last thing on this, just briefly, if I can. The reason we brought up the Ebola thing was not, we were yesterday talking about the incredible pieces in the New Yorker and the New York Times about the so-called burial boys and these courageous nurses who were shunned by their husbands and their families and their towns. It's just horrible. But the larger thing is the level of misinformation about things that I would naively assume, since they're in the news nonstop, would get more accuracy in the minds of the American people. Do people like you talk about this and talk about talking to media people about getting correct information out on things that matter? Or do we just sort of wring our hands at these things? Does anything happen?
So I try to sort of straighten out media people when I can. The other thing that I do is, you may have noticed this, I think I even shared it with you. I wrote a column for the Washington Post and I said, look, what did the two white doctors get the experimental medicine? And why did no one in Africa do it? And I found out it wasn't bias and it wasn't discrimination. It was simply that the evangelical organization that had sent those two doctor or the doctor and the hospital administrator over there asked. They tracked down the drug and said, oh, would you give it to these two people? And the company said, oh, okay. Nothing more than that. They happened to have an organization that was zealous enough to chase the drug down that worked on their behalf. But there was a ton of misinformation. We were favoring white people. We liked rich people. We liked Americans. We liked doctors. So if you want to cover this kind of an epidemic, you have to know that there's a lot of distrust, fear, suspicion out there, and you start from that. You don't start from neutrality.
We're talking with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. All right, let's move on to this whole ice bucket challenge, which is kind of sweeping America. Tom Keene writes a column for the Boston Globe, and he was praising the president for refusing to do the ice bucket challenge, mm-hmm. saying he's going to write a check, and contrasting that to Charlie Sheen. We haven't heard from Charlie in quite some time, but Charlie Sheen apparently did the ice bucket challenge, and Oprah did the ice bucket challenge.
I think Charlie's been in a lot of buckets for many years, but...
That's probably
long before this.
It's probably true.
Long before the change.
Yeah, we went to a show of his, but we won't get into that. That was one of the more embarrassing moments of my entire life.
Yes, it was.
But in any case, Tom Keene's question was: is this a gimmick or not? The ALS has raised an awful lot of money.
Oh, it's a gimmick, but it's just a useful gimmick. I mean, it is. You know, if you go up on your Facebook page or social media, you can see all of your friends throwing. Ice over their head or water over their head or falling down and half killing themselves, throwing giant amounts of ice over their heads. It's a gimmick. It worked. It caught on. ALS benefited, got many more donations than they would have. I think it's silly. One of my friends with ALS said to me, I don't care if it's silly. I don't care if it's a gimmick. Keep throwing water over your heads. I want that money collected. But hopefully we could raise funds for diseases without going through that kind of rigmarole. But you know, that's sort of the way it is. The other problem with it, which people haven't really said much about, is if you're writing a check for ALS, how about asthma and what about diabetes and what about cancer and what about mental health? They need help too. So part of the problem with gimmick-driven fundraising is it sort of distorts where the gifts go.
Yeah, but the level of contribution, I have to say I'm totally with your friend with ALS, is one, uh-huh. Of course it's a gimmick. And Keene goes on to make the point, not just that it's a gimmick, obviously. He ends by saying threats to compel giving, which is essentially what it is, you either do the challenge or write a check. Mm-hmm. It seems the opposite of what really means to be charitable. My sense is you do whatever is ethical to raise money for something you care about. What is the number so far? $78 million raised in the same period of time that $2 million have been raised last year. And I totally relate to the point you're making about comparable charities. But then the answer is you have to be creative too. And I don't mean another ice bucket challenge kind of thing. There's simply not enough money on research. Would you consider a friend of ours, Billy Starr, runs the Pan Mass Challenge. He was on with us a couple of weeks ago. I believe it is the single largest fundraising event, at least athletic event. It's a two-day thing where they raised $40 million this year for Dana-Farber to fight cancer. Well, you could make the same case there. Well, by Billy and his colleagues being so successful, what about all those other charities? Well, then the answer is they've got to be creative too, no?
They do, and the problem is when you get into the creativity escalation wars, think about the walkathons.
Right.
Susan B. Komen and so on. They started out, you walked, I don't know, a mile. Now they're walking about 45,000 miles. You have to walk to Argentina and back. They're running out of creativity on the walking end. So that's just the problem is you get into these escalations. There's only so many ways you can be creative. I'm kind of with you on this one, Jim, because I think, you know, you got your money, you got your gimmick, good for you. I'm just suggesting when you take out that check and you're sort of paying attention to the ice bucket challenge, you might remember that there's other diseases that could use some help too. Make that part of your general giving.
By the way, that was not a criticism. That was an observation. After the bombing of April 15th a year ago, a lot of local charities suffered big time because there was such huge level of contribution to the one fund, obviously.
But you know what drives me crazy, too, in the whole cancer wars thing? Every year, I really don't like this pink thing for breast cancer and these ridiculous bracelets. Jim's think they're great. I love boobies at these little boys, 14-year-old boys, allegedly raising awareness for breast cancer. I think most people over the age of 10 are well well aware of breast cancer. And then you look at other things, and this is not at all, obviously, to disparage breast cancer and people who suffer from it, but you look at things like ovarian cancer that are, in many cases, much more of a sure killer of women with very little signs, very little marketing. So it's kind of like you can do a lot for breasts because they're breasts, and you can't do that much for ovaries because they're just not, frankly, as sexy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I was waiting for the, you know, great rally for incontinence.
It's, exactly.
It's a common problem. Don't really talk about it. Don't think we're going to see too many celebrities jumping out and saying, yes, yes, that's something I have.
Yeah.
Mental health has this problem, too. There are some kinds of mental illness. Robin Williams, you see it happen. You might get some money going that way. But other types, you know, schizophrenia and other terrible mental illnesses, they're just too frightening to us. So some things become pariahs. That's my point. You can't attract a celebrity. You can't. They're not photogenic. They're just too, I don't know, yucky. And that's a problem because they need support too, but we tend to go, particularly in American fundraising, toward the, you know, who's got the best celebrity behind you.
Yeah.
We're talking to Art Kaplan, medical ethicist extraordinaire. Art, I want you to listen to a commercial that I have totally fallen in love with, both because of the product they're selling and because of the approach. Here it is.
Baby carrots, baby carrots, whoa, baby carrots.
That's all you really need to hear. This is the product of a guy who is a former top executive at Coca-Cola, sort of the antithesis of baby carrots, who has decided to start using the same marketing, I was going to say scam, it's not a scam, techniques to sell non-junk food to kids. Is this, and by the way, it's apparently very successful, baby carrots are exploding in terms of sales. Is this an aberration, an outlier, or is this going to move us more in the direction of convincing young kids who continue to have a real serious overweight / obesity problem that healthy food is sort of cool, too?
I hope it's not an aberration. I fear it is. I love what this guy's doing. And, you know, I've said many a time, no wonder we have a childhood obesity problem. On one side stands Ronald and the King, and some of the best advertising ever concocted with presents and little kiddie meals and so on and so on. And the other side is some poor pathetic schnook with a poster of an apple. It's like, okay, we'll see who's going to win this thing. So I love what this guy's doing. I think in some ways the ad agencies ought to be contributing like 10% of what they do to those kind of campaigns. That would be the right moral thing to do if you market it or advertise. Throw some of that great, intelligent, creative stuff behind, you know, good nutritional products, too.
You know, what this reminds me of, and it's not totally on point, but it's sort of on point. Marjorie and I discussed this in our former radio life. About 10 years ago, there was a survey done. I'm not sure who did the survey, that showed that 95%, this number is emblazoned in my head, of children in America recognized Joe Camel, meaning the image for Camel cigarettes, which was even larger percentage than kids who could identify Mickey Mouse. And the evidence there is so clear is the bad guys got the message about how to market bad things. And why is it taking so long for the good guys to get with the program in terms of advertising good things? You know what I mean?
I do, and I think it's two things. One, good advertising's expensive. Good guys' budgets are lower. And two, there's a certain, I don't know, sneering at the advertising and marketing side, and it goes back to something we were talking about a little bit earlier about Ebola. Oh, well, if we just lay the facts out and we sort of explain things clearly to people, they'll get it and they'll do the right thing. And it's sort of like, really? You think so? You know, ever, like, leave your academic office or wander out of your small cubicle in the bureaucracy? People don't behave just on information. They behave on marketing and the push of the message and all that sort of thing. But I'm not sure, you know, where I live in academia, we all believe, well, if we get the facts right, everybody will do the right thing.
Yeah, Jim thinks that, don't you, Jim?
I used to. I don't anymore. That's when I was young and naive.
We're talking with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. Art, this is a timely story because schools are starting. Some of them have already started. Lots of them are starting next week. And there's all these studies over and over again. There's just another one in The Atlantic saying that kids are not getting enough sleep, especially teenagers. And one of the big problems is schools start too early for these kids. You know, they have to get on the bus at 7 o'clock in the morning. couldn't this be some kind of campaign that the AMA or the Pediatricians of America or something?
Or the medical ethicists of America.
Yeah, could get behind.
Hey, listen, sometimes, you know, you think to yourself you were just born too late. Having dragged myself out to Saxonville Elementary at, I think, 3:30 in the morning every day for 6 years, where were these people when I needed them? So, yeah, the data looks pretty clear. To come back to the message, it's clear. Kids need more sleep. Getting them up early sleep deprives them. They're kind of sleep deprived anyway because they're staying up too late doing social media and stuff like that, which interferes with their sleep. But I don't see any reason why we couldn't start school a little bit later and sort of be in sync with what we know about sleep behavior. So, yeah, I think the ethicists and the docs and everybody else should get on board this. And if they want to help kids go to sleep, they can take all those old posters of apples and put them in their bedrooms and
hey, you know,
snoring instantly.
But there's another aspect of this. I know we just mentioned it in another context, in the context of baby carrots, and it's one of my obsessions, I think, as you've learned in our radio relationship. Sleep deprivation and obesity in kids, there's a connection there too, correct?
Correct. Not even sure I understand all the biology, but it absolutely is true. If you don't sleep enough, there's a tendency to put on weight.
Yeah, and this is particularly a problem for teenagers, this early in the morning thing. I mean, you might be able to do it when you're 6 without too much trouble. When you're 16, it's really hard to get up so early in the morning, and they're not.
Right, and it would also add to family amity. Some of my most exciting moments were spent screaming at my son to get up.
Exactly.
Maybe for, I don't know, an hour and 30 minutes straight, something like that.
Yeah.
High school.
Hey, Art, before you go today, it was about a month ago when we last spoke to you about this. You're co-hosting this new podcast called Everyday Ethics. Tell us a little bit about it and where it is, if you would.
So it's on iTunes. It's just a show that takes my understanding of science and medicine and distorts it into trying to comment on broader topics about ethics. We sort of have fun just pulling up, anything and everything to discuss. I've got a partner, Kelly McBride, who works at a think tank for journalism down in Florida called the Poynter Institute. You guys may have heard of
that.
Sure,
oh, absolutely.
And so Kelly and I have been friends a long time, and she basically takes a lot of incorrect positions, and then I fix them during this thing.
I hope you don't do
it's
that
very
stupid.
Similar to what you two do, actually.
Yeah, but you're not doing that stupid thing where you rely upon facts on this podcast, are you?
No, trying to market that, right? Facts barely enter into any of the ethical prescriptions that are offered.
Perfect.
Okay, all right.
We'll be checking it out. Thanks, Art.
Very much.
My pleasure.
For being with us. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. As Jim just said, he's also the co-host of the new podcast, Everyday Ethics. So coming up, we've got Art Kaplan's take on giving kids more sleep. Now it is time to hear from you. Where are you on pushing the school day back? That debate is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we were talking to medical ethicist Art Kaplan about new research on children and sleep. Well, it turns out kids need at least 9.5 hours of sleep every night. However, the National Sleep Foundation reports close to 60%, 58% to be precise, 58% of 15 to 70-year-olds sleep fewer than 7 hours each night. So one way to give kids the sleep they need is to move the school day back. Is this good for kids' physiology but bad for the entire family's way of life? Our number is 877-301-8970. We'd love to hear from teachers, too. Are you for starting the day later if it means you're teaching a room of well-rested kids, or does a later school day just beget a later everything, including bedtime? 877-301-8970. We've talked about this in the past. Let me just say, I hate the expression no-brainer, so can I get one pass and use it once?
Certainly.
This is the ultimate no-brainer. I know what the arguments against this are. I'll recite them in a minute. But is this not almost a walkover, how clear it is that this needs to be done?
Well, you have the American Academy of Pediatrics, as we talked about a little bit with Art. They're definitely on the side of this, and they point out that especially for teenagers, and some schools have done this. I said this before in Brookline, where my kids went to school.
Yeah, you're
the high school started later. Started at
what 8, time?
8:30.
Uh-huh. From what? What was the original time?
Eight.
Eight, okay.
And they moved it up a half hour so kids could sleep later. And there's all this research that says that kids are, teenagers, That's how they're built. They don't feel sleepy until much later at night because of this delayed release of melatonin in the adolescent brain. So that's why your kids, their teenagers, are up until 2 o'clock in the morning and they want to sleep until noontime because that's sort of their natural kind of thing. I mean, they can't sleep till noontime, obviously, but sometimes they do on the weekends. You know how it is on the weekends with teenagers?
They're yes, I do.
In bed forever.
I used to have too.
So it partly is that they're recovering and partly is that just the way they're built.
Well, let me give you the primary arguments that one writes about or hears about on both sides of this. The primary arguments, which I think are overwhelming in favor of a later school day, driving, this is no particular order, far safer, far fewer accidents, better grades, better understanding, less obesity, psychologically healthier, and something I hadn't thought about until one of our, was it somebody on Facebook at Boston Public Radio who did this? Oh, here it is. Yeah, Phil. Start later and end later for sure. Not only would it be better for them in the morning, but there would be a lot less time to find trouble in the afternoon. Seeing teens on the street at 2 p.m. after school always gets me wary and recalling the half year on double sessions when I got out at noontime. Worst semester ever. Lots of trouble in the afternoon. In fact, the highest crime period, if I remember correctly, for teenagers is the afternoon after school. So it would reduce that. Those are the arguments which I think are overwhelming. The arguments you hear in response, Marjorie, which you and I have heard through the years when we've discussed this, athletics. They happen in the afternoon, even though the data suggests that there is not lower participation, even if it starts later.
Excuse
What's
me. That? I think parents would be interested to hear from parents whose kids have done athletics in high school. I mean, we're not talking about the NBA and the NFL here. You don't have to practice quite so long in the afternoon. I think you can sneak by with maybe a half hour short of practice in the afternoon.
I'm with you.
And get home a half hour earlier for dinner.
And it's other things. Parents and transportation problems. And then the one that I have to say I have the hardest time responding to, but not that a hard time, is that families which are dependent on incomes of students who work in the afternoon, if there's less time to work, there's less income. That is not an insignificant issue, but I think it's overwhelmed by the benefits. You know, we used to talk all the time to David Driscoll, who used to be the commissioner of education for Massachusetts?
Yes, he was the state. He was a great guy.
He was terrific. And one of the things he said to us that I'll never forget, even though if I get it wrong, I'm sure I'll be corrected in a second. I hope I'm corrected anyway, that the school year and school hours had not been changed since we were an agrarian nation. Isn't that what he said?
Well,
He
talked about the idea that the schools are the only thing that functions like we still are an agrarian nation. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the reasons that you get out in June and went back in September was so you could help, the kids could help for the harvest around, the farm. And that also in the noontime thing where people used to go home for lunch was because most mothers were still at home preparing lunch and most kids walked back and forth to school. That's all.
And
so
help
different.
With the farm. Yeah. 877-301-8970. So some school systems, New York City, Brookline, as you just heard, are experimenting. I don't think they should be experimenting. They should just be doing it. Later school day, which side are you on and why? And if there are inconveniences, serious ones, please give us a buzz and let us know what you think they are.
And the other thing is we should point out there's a physiological thing. It's not just with the melatonin.
Totally true.
I mean, when you have little kids, you know, the little kids, I mean, they're up at 5 in the morning, 5:30, 6, you're going absolutely nuts. And they hit puberty and everything changes. So it's harder for them to get to sleep at night too, which is another thing. I mean, they're not like grown-ups or little kids. They could pass out at 10 o'clock. Teenagers have a tougher time getting to sleep early.
Dream, by the way, is someday to make it to 10 o'clock again. That's
yeah,
my hope.
You're an early riser.
I'm an early sleeper, too.
Mark from Fairhaven, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Great.
Excellent. Thank you.
I think it's a horrible idea.
Why is that?
I think that parents should take a little initiative and stop parenting and get the kids off of the computer and off of the social media and the Twitter and the Facebook and get the kids to go to bed. When I was a kid, my parents didn't go to bed. I went to bed. I have an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old, and they're getting plenty of sleep because I take the electronics away from them at night.
I bet they are. And by the way, I think Art Kaplan mentioned this. I'm not sure. But not only do you speak a lot of truth, assuming that most parents have the power to make that happen, but secondly, apparently all that electronic stuff that kids are engaged in late at night, even when they decide to shut it off, interferes with their ability to go to sleep. So in an ideal world, Mark, I think you've got it nailed, but my guess is a lot of parents listening saying that I'm not going to be able to pull that off. Mark, thanks for the call.
Ninmar and Worcester, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Hi.
Hello there.
Yeah, you got it right.
Hi, thanks. Ninmar.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd just like to say, I don't think the problem is with pushing it back or forward or anything like that. I just got out of school not too long ago, and I had to wake up at 6 in the morning. And the problem is you get out of school at like 2:30 or 1:30, and you got like 6 or 7 classes in the day, and each teacher assigns an hour of homework every day. So you're supposed to finish all your homework, and then you're supposed to go to school, you know, and you're not, like, there's no time for anything else.
Yeah.
It really isn't.
You know, you raise a great point. That's another one of my pet peeves.
I'm with
too
you.
Much homework. I mean, it's just crazy. And then if you're trying to work a job to help your parents out financially, or you're doing sports, then you're going to be up until 2 o'clock in the morning anyway, trying to do all the homework. You're
By the way,
right.
Nidmar, a lot of experts think, Marjorie and I both support, I think we do, I know I do, longer school days.
I do.
One of the things that people talk about on longer school day is not just more instruction, but giving kids time to do their homework there so that they don't have to take it home. So it's in school
and so
work.
So they can get help.
So they, exactly. That's
one of the best
great
things
reason,
about
yeah.
charter schools that are open until 5 and 6 o'clock at night. That they have tutors there to help you, because I don't know about you, I couldn't pass.
No,
once
true.
My kids got past the third grade, I was no longer able to help them with their math.
Nidmar, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970. New research suggests, and now with the weight of the American Academy of Pediatrics behind it, that not only are kids not getting as much sleep, but it's affecting a whole spectrum of behaviors. Their performance in school, their ability to drive safely, their body shapes, their psychology, their criminality, even. And there's a move, a modest move, I should say, to start school later to accommodate this. Do you support that move?
Siobhan from Plimpton. Hi, Siobhan.
Hey, Siobhan.
How are you?
Excellent.
Great.
There's a couple of points that you've mentioned, but there's another point where the school day itself is so compact. I have a 16-year-old in high school, and yes, the screaming and yelling to get up in the morning is annoying. I have to get up in the morning early just to get my child up at 5:30 to make the 6:30 bus. Staying for mom because I'm tired and I work late sometimes. So if I'm getting home at 9 o'clock at night, and then I have to do the daily mom stuff, and then you have to make sure your kid's in bed, I'm usually crashed. And I'm assuming my child has gone to sleep. But like they say, they're not to sleep until like 3 in the morning. But lunch, they have like 20 minutes to get in line, get their lunch, and eat their lunch. And they not get rushed through their school day.
Yeah.
So they don't have enough time in any class to actually sit down and digest what it is that they're trying to learn. Never mind the fact that the teachers are giving them half of the information they're supposed to learn at home at during their homework. They're not actually teaching them much in the classroom itself.
Hey, Siobhan, can we get back to the 5:30, 6:30 thing? What time does your kid start school that he or she has to be on a bus at 6:30?
They start, I think, at 7:10, but because where we have a Silver Lake district, and the kids get picked up from 3 different towns, so there's few buses, so they have to go to the outskirt towns and get the kids, get them to the school, which is nuts. I mean, I'm like, I would rather just drive my kids to school in the morning, which actually is still too early, but it's crazy. They still start. They have to be outside at 6:30. Or the bus will go right by. They won't even slow down if they don't see the child.
Can I tell you something? If there's ever we've ever heard exasperation in the voice of a caller, it is in you. Siobhan, you expressed yourself beautifully.
Well,
thank
how about
you.
These Metco kids from Boston that participate yeah. in a school in Lincoln? I mean, I think they have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, Jim, to get there.
No, it really, it is so obvious to me.
I suppose you can pass out on the bus on the way.
That this should be, is there any, other than the income thing that I mentioned before, which is not an insignificant issue for low and moderate income families, what other possible argument is there against this, except this is the way we do things? Meaning we don't change the way we do things. What argument is there against this?
Teacher second jobs.
No, I mean, this is an opportunity for Marjorie to take a shot at the teachers and the teachers' union. It's really,
sorry, Jim.
No, the beauty, your ability to integrate that into virtually any, we're going to be talking about workplace movies a little later. See if you can work
it
into that.
Crazy. That's
Alex,
why I do it.
You're in Worcester. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hello there, Alex.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. How are you?
We're
great.
Excellent. Thank you for the call.
Great. Big fan of yours. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm the head of school of a Jesuit middle school
in
Massachusetts. And we are a tuition-free private school, and we serve boys from low-income homes.
Mm.
So
Can we ask what the name is?
Sure. Nativity School of Worcester.
Great.
Yeah,
thank you.
The Nativity Prep Schools are great. They are just great
right.
places.
And, so we're part of a Nativity model. There are over 60 schools across the country. But we have an extended day and an extended school year. So we're in school 11 hours a day from 7:40 in the morning till 6:30 at night with middle school boys. And we also go to school year-round. We have a break in June and a break in August, but we're in school all of July. You know, we find our boys come to school, come to us in fifth grade, below grade level, in all areas that we assess. And we found it to be a way to combat that, to get them into some of the best high schools in the area once they graduate from our school. And, you know, the extended school day, you know, what's interesting about our school is that they arrive at 7:40, but they actually don't touch their first academic class until 8:45.
What do they do for the first hour and 5 minutes, Alex?
So for the first hour and 5 minutes, we provide breakfast for all of our students. You know, we provide, you know, three meals a day at the school, knowing full well, again, 100% of the boys admitted into the school qualify for free or reduced breakfast or lunch. The average income of our incoming class is $21,000 for the family, family income of $21,000. So we provide them with breakfast, which, again, gets their day off right. Then from there, they meet with an advisor for 10 minutes to check in. Every day they meet with an adult. Four or five students meet as a group. Then they have silent reading for 15 minutes, and it's easing them from kind of street mode to school mode. And the last portion is we have a 20-minute morning assembly. It's our community time. But so I'm not sure about starting the school day later. I mean, that's obviously we're doing that, but kind of, you know, rethinking the way the school day is structured might be an interesting thing for schools to.
Alex, I have to say, virtually everything you said sounds so appealing to me. It is stunning. However, do you not worry, even though you ease into the school day, maybe that's not a verb you would use, but you do ease into the studying part of the school day for that first hour and 5 minutes. Do you not worry about the sleep deprivation issue? Because the research is pretty overwhelming.
Well, on the flip side, in the afternoon, the reason we're in school till 6:30 is that we provide an hour and a half for our students at the end of the school day to do their homework.
Hmm.
So they get out of class at 3:45, and then from 3:45 to 5, they're involved in some sort of athletic activity, whether it's intramurals or interscholastic sports. And then from 5 to 5:15, they have a snack, and then from 5:15 to 6:30, they are working on their homework. Once a week, they're tutored by an undergraduate college student. So they're getting individualized tutoring at least once a week. But by the time the goal is by the time they leave our school at 6:30 at night, their work is done. They can go home, be with their family, and get to bed at a decent time.
Let me ask you one last thing, Alex. Brag a little bit. These kids, you mentioned that they go on to good high schools. I would presume they go on to college, most of them as well.
They do. So, yeah, so 100%. We're in our 12th year as a school. We were founded in 2003. We just opened our 12th year. 100% of our graduates, we have 113 graduates from the school. 100% have been accepted into private high schools and receive sufficient financial aid to go. About 90% go on to private high schools. About 90% have gone on to a post-secondary, you know, opportunity, whether it be, you know, some sort of trade or vocational or a four-year college or a community college. So, I mean, we're seeing great success with the population. When you look at the demographic, you know, when you look at the statistics of who is least succeeding in school right now, it's male students of color, and we are 97% male students of color, 100% free reduced lunch.
Hey, Alex, can you hold on for a second and give your phone number or email address to one of our producers that we'd like to continue the conversation with you off air if we can?
Yeah, there's an
absolutely, I'd love to.
Alex, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it.
In Boston, too, with also great records. And, you know, Alex brings up one of the great problems. So many parents now are working. This is not about getting up early in the morning, but I just got to point this out.
No, it's a hugely important thing.
That not only are the parents not home, but the parents don't have the wherewithal. Like I said, I couldn't help my kids with math to help their kids with their homework. And it's really hard when your kid doesn't understand it and you don't understand it, and they have to kind of call their other classmates.
No, I totally agree with you.
So you can't learn unless they have the advantage of having a tutor. And tutors, of course, are very expensive. That's why the all-day school thing to 5 or 6 o'clock at night to me is so appealing.
I hesitate to say this to you, but one of the reasons I wanted to talk to Alex off-air is to get his sense of how much of what he does is transferable to a public school setting. Don't say what you're thinking. Just do us all a favor, Marjorie, and keep it to yourself.
I mean, do you a favor?
No, do me and do everybody a favor,
okay,
and just
Jim.
Hold on to it.
Okay.
Douglas.
Let's go to Douglas in Portsmouth. Hi, Douglas.
Hello, Douglas.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
This topic definitely has many branches on the tree. Definitely school starting later has been discussed, and I approve of that as well. But one of the key points a lot of callers have talked about is the restructuring of school itself. You guys talked about the agrarian style. I'll go even further to the industrialized mechanical mode of how education is delivered, as if students are factory parts. Mm. And if you look at when we went from one-room schoolhouses to more public school settings, that's exactly the theory that was adopted for the educational system. If you look at people like Sir Ken Robinson, Dr. Alfie Cohn, and Dr. Sugata Mitra, who are completely changing how people learn, you can teach more in less time by doing it a more efficient way. And that's what needs to happen.
How about greater efficiency and more time? How about that? Is that what's the downside of that? Even if you can use the few hours that one is in school better and more efficiently than one does,
The neurosciences have already shown that the brain only absorbs so much in a certain amount of time, and any extra time thrown onto it is not necessarily retained at the proper level. And so by throwing more hours at a student, isn't necessarily going to give them better retention.
I hear you. And obviously, Alfie Cohn is a local guy, and I've read a lot of his stuff. But I think the issue is what you, quote, do throw at a student to make sure that they can retain it. And obviously, the diversity of program, which is one of the things Alex was talking about a while ago, I think helps there. But Douglas, thank you for contributing your ideas. We appreciate it. Want to do one more, Marjorie,
sure.
quickly?
Sure. John from Bristol, Rhode Island. What a pretty town, John. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
So I have a civil engineering and a more philosophical argument against changing the the structure of the school day. So
Civil
engineering standpoint, most places of business tend to start around 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. So if we have school systems and employees all racing out, cluttering up the highways at the same time, we have a bottleneck.
That's a good point, John.
So I think that would be probably the strongest argument against doing this. And for people who live in urban areas, I think they would probably chime in and agree.
Well, you know, sadly, I think that has some legitimacy as well, John. But I like to think, even though I am not a traffic planner, but I should have been, actually. It's an area of great interest, John. Thank you for your call.
I didn't know that,
Jim. I find it – maybe you have a separate lane, like an HOV lane. You have a school kind of lane mm-hmm. But that is a legitimate issue. John, thanks for the call.
I'd forgotten about your investigative reporting that you did for the Boston Globe last week on traffic lanes and bicycles.
Well, you didn't even read the piece I had in the Sunday Globe magazine, did you? Did you? Tell the truth.
Didn't I look at that before it went
I may
in?
Have shown it to you before it went in, yes. But, I mean, talking about in the magazine itself. And by the way, if you didn't get the magazine or if you've already tossed it, you can Google it. Google Browdy and Globe and bicycles,
Bikes.
You might find the piece. And I thought it was quite fine.
It was fantastic. It was brilliant.
Well, actually, it was a good piece.
It was brilliant.
Everybody
said so.
I'm not saying it was brilliant, but it was a good piece.
Okay.
Boston Globe magazine this past Sunday.
Okay.
Thank you.
Coming up.
It has John Kerry on a pink... I mentioned John Kerry on a pink bike.
Oh.
On the Vineyard.
Really?
On the Nantucket.
Do you have the picture of him?
No,
I mentioned him
coming
right.
to the rescue and trying to negotiate peace between cyclists and drivers. Go ahead, Marjorie.
Coming up, Labor Day is almost here, and Garen Daly, our film critic, he's going to join us to talk about workplace films in honor of Labor Day and how things have changed as we've moved from the steel plant to Silicon Valley. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Never mind that today is probably one of the warmest days that we've had the entire summer. It's about time. We're just a few days shy of Labor Day, and of course that means the end of summer, which of course means a full-bodied return to work. Here with us in Studio 3 for a sober reminder of what that entails on film is film critic Garen Daly. Garen, it's great to see you.
Hi, guys.
So you are going to tell us how movies about work have changed over the years. What is your thesis, please, Garen Daly?
My thesis is that since the 80s, it's really changed as we've had an identity crisis in the workplace, and it's reflected in films. But, you know, I just wanted to, you know how I love to go way back
yes,
in
you
history.
Do.
We like that, too.
You
actually,
know,
we do.
1895, the first actual factory film was done by the Lumiere brothers. It's called The Factory Doors, and it's 45 seconds, one of the very first films ever made, of women walking out of the Lumiere brothers' factory. So it goes that far back where we've been talking about our work and how it impacts our lives.
By the way, I love that film. You know what I like? I like short films.
It's great in HD, you know? And the 3D, yeah. The 3D effect is amazing.
But you did go back to one of my favorite movies. I don't want to mention this if I shouldn't at this point, but I was talking to Jim about this. The Apartment, which is an old movie, and that was sort of the great post-war America, you know, everybody in the little rows of desks and working in these great big places in Manhattan. But did you want to start there?
Wherever we want to start is fine. And, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. And you mentioned that particular scene.
Yes.
Because that scene shows Jack Lemmon, who plays this kind of organizational everyman, has just been promoted. And he's picking everything up out of his desk, and he's walking past these rows and rows and rows and rows of films. And that is an homage to the 1927 film The Crowd by King Vidor, who Wilder obviously recognized. So there was a nice bit going on there. And then he goes into his office where all the guys who helped him get along, we'll explain this in a second, but all the guys are like on his case about what he is going to do for them.
Well, you made it. Just like we promised.
Quite an office. Name in the door, rug in the floor, the whole schmear. Yeah.
Teamwork, that's what counts in an organization like this. All for one and one for all. Know what I mean?
Yeah, I have a vague idea.
Baxter, we're a little disappointed in you, gratitude-wise.
Oh, I'm very grateful.
Then why are you locking us out?
Well, after all, it's my apartment. It's private property. It's not a public playground.
All right, so you got yourself a girl. That's okay with us, but not every night in the week.
How selfish can you get? Last week, I had to borrow my nephew's car and take Sylvia to a drive-in in Jersey. I'm too old for that sort of thing.
I sympathize with your problem. Believe me, I'm very sorry.
You'll be a lot sorrier before we're through with you.
Are you threatening me?
Listen, Baxter, we made you and we can break you.
And so just to set up if people don't know what The Apartment is about, Jack Lemmon is this lower echelon worker who has his apartment in downtown New York, and all the other executives who are above him are using it for their trysts and their assignations. And now that he's been promoted, he is now, you know, kind of freezing them out because he's got this new girl.
So, you know, when we were reading some of the thoughts that you conveyed about this is, we had a discussion with you several weeks ago about priests in movies through the years. And you made the case, I think pretty convincingly, that how priests were portrayed in film was totally a function of how priests were perceived in society at that point in time. The history of films about work is, I mean, I guess this is not surprising, the exact same thing, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And when you think about that, The Apartment was made in 1960. We've had a decade of people working in the offices, this post-manufacturing period out of World War II. We're now living in the suburbs. We now have all these people working in these offices. And, you know, it became a little bit of a situation where you're always working for a company and you felt you had security. And that's where the thesis comes into play, because when you get into the 70s and 80s, that concept is different. It may be that you're an organizational man and it's not great and you've got to use sex to get forward, you know, or giving an apartment for sex. But when you get into the 80s, there are all sorts of different kinds of films coming out. Remember Mr. Mom?
Of course.
Okay.
Unfortunately. Go ahead. Yes.
And Gung Ho?
No.
I don't remember Gung Ho.
Gung Ho was Michael Keaton playing a guy who runs a factory, a car factory, that has to sell his basic soul to the Japanese so that they can keep the town going. So in these films, you're starting to see things about racism, sexism, you know, this kind of xenophobic thing going on, because we no longer had security.
Yeah.
And a perfect example of that is, you know, Working Girl. Directed by Mike Nichols, starring Melanie Griffith and Harrison Ford, Sigourney Weaver, great, great cast. But it's a story about this young girl who is kind of frozen out. She's, you know, she's smart, she's intelligent, but she's a girl from the wrong side of the tracks.
It's a working class kid.
It's a working class kid, and trying to break through that glass ceiling, just trying to get going. And in fact, she's very much aware of it, because one of the most famous quotes in the film is this one.
Business and a bod for sin. Is there anything wrong with that?
That was great. And by the way, if I remember correctly, I haven't seen this in years. This is a film where her boss is Sigourney Weaver, right?
Correct.
Who I love. And they're roughly the same age.
Yes.
And they just come at things differently. This Melanie Griffith is sort of is a working class kid. Is she from Staten Island or some
very good memory.
That kind of thing. And Sigourney Weaver is the deep voiced, you know, perfect executive. Then something happens to Weaver.
She gets hurt and she wants Tess
skiing accident.
And so then Tess fills in essentially
and decides
and cuts this deal, which is how she ends up in bed with this business guy. Right. Correct.
Right. And the business guy is played by Harrison Ford. And of course, Joan Cusack is around for some great comedy. And it's also the time when you had big hair versus, you know, more conservative cuts. So there's this costuming going on. And think about the 80s fashions for women in business. They had these big shoulders,
yep,
the pads.
Right.
And part of that was so they would be a little more masculine. But and again, when we get to the end of Working Girl, which, you know, is successful through the ups and downs. I love the ending more than anything else, because if you remember the ending, she makes it. She's got a corner office. It's beautiful. But as you leave the movie, there's this long tracking shot coming away from her office on the outside. And then you get to see more and more windows of this building. Then you get to see the building. Then you get to see the city, this entire city. And she's just this little car.
Tiny.
And
yeah,
she really hasn't made it. And that is a great theme to end up with on that particular film.
Yeah. And you know what was also good about that, too? It was still a time when women succeeding to that level was still unusual. And the whole thing with her previous boyfriend. Who was the boyfriend?
Alec Baldwin.
That's what I thought. Alec Baldwin was the boyfriend. And how much she resented her success outside the neighborhood. It was a great little
thing. Because it challenges masculinity.
Exactly.
Exactly.
We're talking to Garen Daly in honor of Labor Day, which is just a few days away, about the great movies portraying workers, working class environments, and how it evolved through the years. If you've got a favorite or a least favorite that has the workplace as the centerpiece of the movie, give us a buzz. Tell us about it. 877-301 8970. Now, the 60s were a time of people standing up to authority.
Exactly.
How'd that play out?
Well, you mean there are two ways. I mean, you take a look at one of my favorite films is called A Thousand Clowns.
By the way, I would say maybe my favorite movie of all time. I love A Thousand Clowns.
Well, Jason Robards is so great.
Go ahead.
Gene Sachs, who plays the little boy, mm-hmm, his ward, and then there's Barbara Harris. I mean, I fell in love with Barbara Harris in that movie. And for those of people who don't know, Jason Robards plays this brilliant ad guy who has just dropped out. He wants nothing to do with manufacturing or being out in an office or any of that. He wants to be on the streets having a good time and enjoying his life. He goes to the docks to watch the boats go away and says goodbye to everybody, even though he knows nobody. And eventually, though, he's forced into a situation where he has to go back into that world to hold on to this young boy that he really, really loves. And it's a really wonderful story. But getting back to the 60s, that you're starting to see that dropping out aspect of
things.
You know,
it's interesting. You talked about two 60s movies. You talked about A Thousand Clowns and one of Marjorie's favorite, The Apartment, which, yeah, I love as well. I saw The Apartment a few months ago, and it actually holds up pretty well.
It
does. I have purposely not seen A Thousand Clowns in maybe 15 years because I was worried that I was going to see it and be wildly disappointed because it meant so much to me when I saw it in the 60s or the 70s or whatever. Have you seen it in recent years?
I haven't seen it in recent years. I saw a bunch of clips recently, and I liked it still.
Really?
I mean, first of all, watching Jason Robards. He's one of the great American,
yes,
underappreciated, yeah, actors. You know, and Barbara Harris, who went on to be a great diction coach as well, is incredible. She's just, you know, she's gorgeous, she's cute, and it's a well-done film.
877-301-8970. Work. Labor Day is coming up this coming Monday. What's your favorite film about work? What are you smiling at, Margaret?
I was smiling because Christopher just sent a great email and said, I heard someone recently say that the working 9-to-5 line is an anachronism, that many folks would welcome it in these days of a plethora of part-time jobs and very long hours and corporate cuts.
Does It's A Wonderful Life count as a...
Oh, sure, because think about it. Pa Daly is in this grind that his son ends up getting into, and they're constantly fighting. He's totally disillusioned that he wants to go someplace else. He wants to experience the world. Yes, absolutely. It's a Wonderful Life falls into that.
877-301-8970 is the number. 877-301-8970. We're here with Garen Daly, our movie expert. We're talking about movies about work having it changed over the years. Mark from Lunenburg, you are on the air. What do you think, Mark?
Hey, Mark.
Hi, guys. It's the first time I've actually gotten through after about 10 times trying.
We're really glad
terrific.
You did.
Thanks very much. Office Space.
Don't know it.
You know, it's purely, you know, on an emotional level, you know, it's something that everybody can appreciate. You have horrible bosses combined with bureaucracy and the high crime. You know, how common workers are abused to the point where they're willing to consider stealing from the company what they think is just a few fractions of a cent turned into a considerable sum of money and, of course, a felony. But the things that they go through in the office just demonstrates things that we have to endure during our career.
You've gotten Garen Daly smiling. Why are you smiling? Is that a favorite?
Well,
of yours?
First of all, Mark, I'm going to say two words to you, and hopefully you're going to get it. Great. Because that is the guy. Bill Lumberger is the boss who goes around every time he tells someone to do something, ends up going, great.
Oh, terrific.
And, but it is. It's Mike Judge.
The standard response to anybody giving them a serious response to some issue or trying to head off a catastrophe and, you know, or asking them to come in and work on the weekend unpaid or something. Yeah, great. You know, you've got to go to your brother's wedding and you know, give him a ring. Oh, sure. Great. Yeah, I'll see you here on Saturday.
Sounds like you've lived this experience, Mark. Hey, Mark, we're glad you finally got through. Thank you so much.
We have a couple of other
call.
Emailers who are office space
what
fans.
Are they?
Well,
they
just
what she said before.
We have an emailer, Nancy, who's talking about Kinky Boots, the failing business saved by a talented drag queen and an open-minded business owner. That's a play.
Well,
right?
it was a play.
It was
originally one of those small English films where a small manufacturing company, a boot company, goes to London to try and figure out how they can take advantage of what's going on in London to rescue themselves. And what they end up doing is they end up finding drag queens who need reinforced boots, which is why it's called Kinky Boots. But there's actually another film kind of similar to that coming up pretty soon called Pride, which is about the 1984 Welsh coal strike during the Thatcher period.
Oh.
And it's a story about the miners creating an alliance with a gay and lesbian group in London to help them get the word out. So that's not out yet. That's coming out this fall. But again, it's one of those small little English films that I like so
Speaking
much.
Of union things, the two things that come to mind, we had Barbara Coppolan here like several months ago, who's won a couple of Academy Awards, one of which was the great movie, the name of which escapes
Harlan County,
where the coal miners from West Virginia come up to New York City to essentially picket and protest against the board of directors. And there are some scenes, I've mentioned this on the air when she was here, how much I love this scene, where there's a coal miner from West Virginia, I believe, talking to a New York City cop who's very sympathetic. The cops are in a union too. And they are having this conversation, this intense and wonderful conversation about what's covered by their health care. And the woman or the man, I can't remember, from West Virginia turns to the cop and says, "You got dental?" And it was just one of these incredibly real. And the other film that in terms of probably maybe the most popular one ever of this genre in terms of union stuff, Norma Rae, was huge.
Oh, someone's calling about that.
Yeah. I mean, Norma Rae was a monster, wasn't it?
Well, it was a monster.
She won an Academy Award.
An Academy Award, and she really, really, everyone really liked her. You know?
Yeah. How was that as a film? I know it was really popular.
It's actually a very, very good film, and it really does show what happens when workers are kind of not oppressed, but just taken advantage of. And we see that all over, and it plays out time and time again.
Our number is 877-301-8970. I'm sorry, what did you say?
It would be great to have a Market Basket film, wouldn't it, about all the adventures of the people of the Market Basket people?
You don't think somebody's – that's brilliant. You don't think somebody's making that film right now?
I think it would be a great, good idea. Now, how about The Devil Wears Prada? That was Meryl Streep, I think, that she was playing the head of a Vogue magazine.
Right, Anne Hathaway,
and,
yes.
And that was what, the overworked intern film?
Well, but you know, to me, it's more about the myth. Myth of social mobility, which we still adhere to. And there is a group of films that have come out recently which really kind of push that forward, when in reality that social mobility has been squashed. But in this film, Anne Hathaway plays a college grad who's very, very smart, very learned, and she's not into fashion at all, but she gets this gig, and it's slowly how the job changes her and not necessarily for the good. And at the end, of course, she has to go back to her old ways because she's not satisfied in that corporate world. A Sweet Home Alabama is another one of that genre, and there's several others. But, you know, I wanted to go back to Working Girl, which is all about women being oppressed. In Glengarry Glen Ross, we get men being oppressed and having their masculinity totally stripped for the pursuit of the dollar. And Mamet does a great job with the dialogue.
Put that coffee down. Coffee's for closers only. You think I'm f***ing with you? I am not f***ing with you. I'm here from downtown. I'm here from Mitch and Murray. And I'm here on a mission of mercy. You got leads. Mitch and Murray paid good money. Get their names to sell them. You can't close the leads you're given. You can't close s***. You are s***. Hit the bricks, pal, and beat it, because you are going out.
The leads are weak.
The leads are weak. You're weak. I've been in this business 15 years.
What's your name?
You. That's my name. You know why, mister? Because you drove a Hyundai to get here tonight. I drove an $80,000 BMW. That's my name.
Is that the warm and cuddly Alec Baldwin, yes?
That's the warm and cuddly Alec Baldwin. That's the warm and cuddly Ed Harris. It's the warm and cuddly...
He's fabulous.
You know, Kevin Spacey is in that film. Al Pacino, Alan Arkin. And to kind of bring it back to what we... The apartment,
Jack Lemmon.
And, you know, think about those two different roles that he plays in that. I mean, it's that's a testament to who he is and who as an actor. But again, it's all, you know, the reality is that these films are depicting, especially Glengarry and Glen Ross, and The Boiler Room would be another one, where men are no longer able to get satisfaction from their jobs. Their fathers, you know, worked for GM all their lives and had security blankets. Now they are being pushed further and further and further, and it's all about money and not even about satisfaction.
Well, you know, what we're talking about the films that are fiction very close to life, and I mentioned the Barbara Kopple thing, but the other great documentary, which I think is the best thing he's ever done, and of course the name escapes me, the Michael Moore about Flint, Michigan, was his first, what's it called? Roger and Me, of course. About Roger Smith, who was Roger Smith, was then, I believe, the president of GM.
GM,
and obviously
correct.
GM pulled out of Flint, Michigan, and essentially the whole town comes apart. And I think Michael Moore may be from Flint, Michigan,
if I remember correctly.
And I thought, whether you like him or don't like him, it is a brilliant, brilliant movie.
Well, you know, in terms of a film, what he did successfully was just change documentaries. Because he inserted himself into the documentary, and he became as much a part of the scene as anybody else in that documentary, and it changed documentaries.
You know, we just have a couple of minutes left, but there was a Ben Affleck film, which I didn't see, but The Company Men.
Excellent film.
Yeah. Tell us the plot of that.
Well, it actually takes in place in Boston, and it's a company called GTX. Great cast, Tommy Lee Jones, Chris Cooper, Ben Affleck. And it's the story about how this company, GTX, is about ready to go into merger. And to make their bottom line look better, they're just chopping off people at the knees. One of them being Ben Affleck, who is a high-paid executive. And so it's a story of him struggling to, you know, rebound from it. And he ends up having to, you know, put up drywall with his father-in-law, who is crazy about, Kevin Costner. But it ends up on a positive note because Tommy Lee Jones and he start forming a new corporation at the end, reinforcing that myth of mobility again. But it's still a very good film because Chris Cooper's character is devastated in this. And it's one of those films that you should definitely watch.
Well, you know, that is one of the worst things when you hear these stories about people that have been with a corporation, you know, 10 years, 15 years, 20, 25 years, and all of a sudden they get the axe. I mean, I hate those
That
stories.
Heartlessness is continuing with the Y generation people. And the perfect film for that is The Social Network, which, again, you have somebody who is trying to find love, but he's rude, obnoxious. He creates this thing, and it's like, I read someplace, it's like 500 million likes, but no love.
That's a good line.
I'm not sure. I read it someplace.
Yeah. Do we think that the twins, were they guilty or were they not guilty?
the flunker doinks or whatever.
Watch lists, something like that.
Oh, Winklevoss. Winklevoss, our producer says. Winklevoss
so
twins.
I still see
them on TV.
We only have a minute left. In the early days, if people want to go back, not to 1895 and the Lumieres or whatever it was in the 45-second thing. In the early days of great films, what were the great, give us one or two great early films about work.
All right, I'm going to give you two. One is Chaplin's Modern Times.
Oh, of course.
Because
yeah,
that's all about manufacturing. Yeah. And here's one that you probably have not heard of. Akira Kurosawa in 1960 made a film called The Bad Sleep Well, starring Toshirô Mifune, who plays a man trying to avenge his father by working his way up the corporate ladder, and in the process showing how weak and corrupt the entire Japanese corporate structure was.
That's beautiful. Garen Daly, it's great to see you as always.
Thank you for being with us, as always. What's the name of, give me the name of the Orson Welles thing that you do all the time.
The Orson Welles Complex, a documentary film.
Orson Welles Complex, a documentary film. And he is, of course, our film critic here at Boston Public Radio. Thanks for coming here, Alex, as always. And thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we have Open Mic with Alex Beam from the Boston Globe. We also have Attorney General candidate Warren Tolman joining us. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Rosup, Amanda McGowan, and our engineers, Alan Mattis and John Parker. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Alex Browdy.
Alex Browdy, thank you very much. See me and Alex again tomorrow, please. Thanks for tuning in.